I'm Terry Clark, and I want to welcome you to my podcast, Country Gold Backstage.
You're listening to Country Gold. We're backstage here at the Grand Ole Opry, and joining me this week, I'd like to call you a friend now.
Okay. We've been friends for a long time.
We have been, and you're also one of my biggest influences. Kathy Mattea is here. Thanks for joining me, Kathy.
Glad to see you.
You know, you've played here for over 30 years. Does it feel like it's been that long?
Yes and no. Really, I mean, it feels brand new every time. And part of it is that the Opry never, like sometimes it's the Ryman, sometimes it's here. Sometimes there's a million people you know, and sometimes there's a bunch of people that you don't know. And sometimes you run into someone you haven't seen since you were like 20. And so it's always an adventure. So it kind of always feels new. And it's more and more, I've been playing more lately. It feels more like a family, I think, than ever before. I feel like I'm starting to be here enough to really like get to know some of the older people and kind of have a bit of an ongoing conversation with them.
Well, you've built history, you know?
Yeah, it's great.
And I think when we're younger and we become members in our careers and, you know, overdrive and everything, it's everything seems a little like you're in this tube almost. And now I think when the more you show up and you see the same people you do, it's like a reunion every time you're here and you're more comfortable. And
it's so sweet. You know, like Carrie, who's the leader of the band, is married to someone who was in my band playing mm-hmm. keyboards, Catherine, for a long time. And so these kinds of connections start to happen over and over again, you know, and people just show up to play with somebody one night and you haven't seen them in 15 years and they were in a bus wreck with you in Oregon like 20 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, you're catching up. It's just that part is really fun. That's the fun part about having been around long enough to have some, you know, to feel like there's community.
Yeah. You know, the Opry was obviously constantly mentioned in the Ken Burns documentary, Country Music, and you appeared quite a bit in that documentary. I emailed you last week and I was like, holy cow, that it was so awesome to see you in that so much. And I, you know, a lot of people probably have heard of this by now who are listening because it's been talked about so much, the PBS, the documentary on country music. So how did it feel to be interviewed for it? And you also got time with Ken Burns promoting the documentary in New York and D.C. Have you known him up until previously?
Well, yes. When Ken did the Civil War series way back when, the next year, he produced a one-hour special, maybe it was 2 hours, on the music of the Civil War. And his brother directed it, Rick Burns. So I was in that. And it was really neat. They gave me the most popular song from the Civil War. It's called The Vacant Chair. And when I sang that on TV, my mother and all of her sisters, my mom has five sisters, they went crazy calling each other because my great-grandmother used to sing that song.
Oh, wow.
Because she learned it. You know, she was born not too long after the Civil War, so she learned it from her family. And so there were just all of these interesting connections. So I knew him and had met him. I didn't know him well. And actually, it was Dayton Duncan who wrote the movie and is Ken's partner and one of the producers on the film, came to town to show their movie on the Dust Bowl when it was just about to air. And I met him and he said, "We're going to do country music. Can I come to town and talk to you every now and then?" I'm like, "Sure." So John and I would go out to dinner with Dayton and he would just pick our brains and just ask us about our experiences and people that we knew and stories that he'd heard. And over time, we did this over the course of 8 years. And over time, he started coming into town and he became the expert and he was telling us stories about the older history of country music. So it's been a really rich experience.
What was the most surprising thing that you didn't know that you found out during the making of this documentary and watching it?
Oh, gosh, there were all kinds of things. Okay, the most surprising thing was when Rhiannon Giddens name checks me as an influence.
Yes.
I about dropped my teeth. And so that was a lovely moment. You know, you like to think that somebody, you know, likes what you do and that you make a difference for somebody and the music you choose moves people. But to hear someone who is as fierce about music as she is talk about listening to country music in the 90s and, you know, say your name on TV. It's amazing. The other thing is when you go in for your Ken Burns interview, that is like a bucket list moment in your life.
I can imagine.
Something you don't think will ever happen. And It's a little bit disconcerting because he's more famous than you are, you know, I mean, in his way.
He's the documentary king.
You know, the voice in your head is just going, I'm talking to Ken Burns right now. And when Peter Coyote says your name, that narrator on those films, I know him so well. And when he said my name, I just wanted to look at John and laugh. Peter Coyote just said my name and yours.
So a lot of artists noticed like a spike in their album sales on iTunes and stuff like that. What about you? Did you notice any kind of a bit of a bump in that?
Yes. Well, on Wednesday, the last episode aired Wednesday 2 weeks ago or a week and a half ago. And they covered the story of Where Have You Been in the episode.
Yeah.
And the next morning I did get an email. Guess what? You have a record in the top 40 on the iTunes country charts and an album in the top 40 on the country.
That's
iTunes
amazing.
Charts. And I just walked around laughing all day long.
That's amazing. Like, but you know what? Like that song, I would call that your career song, right? That's the song that just it won the awards and it, songs like that, it's so hard to find songs like that now. So I'm not surprised that people who may not be familiar with the song and heard it on the documentary ran out to find it.
Yeah.
Because it's so powerful and so poignant
and
so real.
It's a picture of how easy it is these days. You can go onto iTunes, you can go and surf it up. And if you want to hear the whole song from beginning to end, you can. And it didn't used to be that way. So that was also really nice, you know, to think that people might have had their interest piqued and they went out and were able to find it so easily.
You were a part of a concert at the Ryman that also promoted the documentary that also featured Vince Gill, Marty Stewart, and Ricky Skaggs. Three of my heroes. Can you talk about those guys and what their contributions to our genre have been? I mean, obviously huge, but if you can add your own take on that.
Well, you know, it was one of the things that all the people at Ken Burns Company talked about was they usually have a lot of historians on camera, and they did have people who knew the history of country music, but they said what we found was that we didn't have to put the historians on camera because all the musicians knew their own history. And really it was Merle Haggard and Marty and Ricky and Vince that were sort of the anchors of all of that. Marty has this amazing warehouse that he calls an office. And he's been collecting for years memorabilia and he knows the history of everything. He knows his personal experience goes so deep. Everything from, you know, playing mandolin with Lester Flatt when he was 13 to being in Johnny Cash's band and then having his own career and then going back and being a new, you know, going back into the roots and like, you know, I don't know if they cover, I can't remember if this was in the film, but Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs had not spoken for years, and on their deathbeds, he went and got them together. He was like, "Y'all need to bury the hatchet, and I'm the one to do it." And they kind of had this forgiveness moment. Just so many, you know. And there's Ricky doing "Ruby, Are You Mad at Your Man" at 8 years old with Bill Monroe, and I love it that in the documentary he still calls him Mr. Monroe, even all these years later. You know, everybody calls him Mr.
Monroe. I love that footage of Ricky as a little boy.
Oh my God. And there he is playing the same song. And this Ryman concert, Rhiannon Giddens and Ketch Secor, some of the younger musicians, opened the show with "Ruby, Are You Mad at Your Man?" And it just, they were so eloquent in their filmmaking at taking a song like Mule Skinner Blues and repeating it with artist after artist after artist in decade after decade. And those ran threads through the music as well. It was beautifully done, I thought.
The CMA Awards are coming up, and I'm hearing that they're really focusing on women this year for the show. Have you heard that?
I have heard that.
And what do you think about that?
Well, I always think it's good, especially with all the controversy. It's just so interesting because I remember having some of these same conversations, you know, when I was up for the awards. And it's, you know, you kind of have to, I don't know how it is for you, Terry. I always just thought, I need to make the best music I can. If I make the best music I can and it resonates with someone, then they will come and find me and I will find them. That is what I need to focus on. The rest of it I want to focus on too, but I don't want to take my eye off the ball and get distracted. And to
totally me, agree with you.
For me, that was always like the strategy I tried to go with when I felt frustrated. It was like I try to plow it back into the to this finding the best songs.
And I'm sure you've talked to some young women coming up in the industry about this, you know. And I was recently up in Canada, and I remember a distinct conversation with a female group, and you know, that was the conversation, was how hard it is, how hard it is. And I said, you know, why don't you, you know, and it's, we have to, you know, obviously acknowledge the fact that women aren't getting as much airplay as they did at one time, but at the same time, redirecting that energy into a creative outlet and just making the best music you know, is also something to be aware about.
Well, I'll tell you what I love is there's Miranda Lambert at the height of her career. And what does she do? She gathers up a group of women and goes and makes music with them. She doesn't have to do that.
Yeah.
It's just sheer fun.
Yeah.
And it's really good. And then the high women, the same thing. And I'm with her in the bluegrass world. And there's just, to me, that is women stepping in and saying,
we're making great music.
Exactly.
We're just going to make great music.
Exactly. And support each other.
Yes.
And the other thing that I think is really, it's really good that we're talking about this, because these things can be cyclical in nature. And sometimes the doors do fling back open. And, you know, that's my hope.
Yeah, I think that.
And you've been doing the same thing with Susie and Pam.
Yeah, we've been out touring, Pam Tillis, Susie Boggess. You know, we're all friends. We all know each other very well. And, you know, I see so many, you know, I just feel like it doesn't matter what era it's from. Like, people miss hearing unique female voices singing hit songs because it's not as prevalent at the on the radio stations now. So we may be taking past hits, but we're getting out there, and we're just, sisters are doing it for themselves, and we're playing our instruments, and we're harmonizing, and we are having a ball, you know, off the stage too. But it's,
oh, I've hung with you guys. I know what it's like.
Yeah, we had a slumber party last December.
Party at my house.
Yeah, we did. We had a good time. But you know, I think that kind of camaraderie and showing support to each other, you know, it's not a catty thing. It's not a competitive thing. I think women are really coming together at this point in time, and it's inspiring.
You know, and I remember Sarah McLachlan did this big festival, the Lilith Fair, when the same thing was going on in pop music. Mm-hmm. She was like, yeah, well, you can say what you want, but we're going to do this. And she just was like, we're doing it. And I think this is, you know, that gives me a lot of hope. It's like there's a lot of fierce women out there just kind of taking the reins.
Some new members of the Country Music Hall of Fame have been announced. Brooks and Dunn are being inducted. You have a connection to them. Your former manager worked with them. In fact, he was there the day they were announced as new members. What do you recall about them from the 90s? I mean, you guys were all around at the same time.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I think I said this to someone just this week, who mentioned to me that they were, it was Bill Cody yesterday. Mm-hmm. We were talking about this. And I remember when Bob had been my manager from day one, and he finally retired, but he signed them and they took off, and it was amazing to watch. And I remember going into the office. His office was on Music Row in an old house. And I remember walking in, and there was a wall on one side of the lobby that was just stacked from floor to ceiling with cardboard boxes. And they were boxes of black hats. And they were the hats that Kix would throw into the audience during their show. It was great, man. And there was just all kinds of stuff like that going on.
A hat farm.
The hustle and bustle. It was great.
That's hilarious. Among your friends, Jeff Hanna of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, they are also a part of the Ken Burns documentary. Jeff and his wife, Matresa Berg, are active in the Nashville songwriting community. Are you pretty close to them?
You know, I've known both of them for many years. And I have to say, you know, every once in a while I'm at some event and somebody plays something and I just come up to Jeff and I just start crying one more time. And I have to say, the Circle album changed my life and it's the reason I'm in Nashville, and thank you again. And he's very gracious about it. And then we, you know, pull out guitars and jam. And, you know, Susie has these big jam sessions at her house and they're always there. And I've known them for many, many years. And I have to say, you know, every once in a while it hits me how much Jeff has done and how much Matresa has done. And they're just so much the same as they ever were. Mm-hmm. You know, they're very down to earth and really talented. And I always call Jeff Hanna the Dick Clark of music. I mean, he doesn't change.
No, he still looks the same too.
Yeah.
Neither one of them age.
No, and they wear it very lightly. They wear it all really lightly.
Hey, you know, I remember her saying to me one time, we're lifers. Like, they're just such soulmates. It's just, and they're so, in every facet, you know, they just connect on every level.
It just seems very effortless.
Absolutely. You did this show a couple years ago. I got to interview you when I was first starting Country Gold, actually. And since then, you've released a new album called Pretty Bird. Mm-hmm. So talk about making that record. It's acoustic with some covers, including Ode to Billy Joe.
Yes.
So what made you go down that road? Well, or off that bridge,
so to speak. Yeah. I went through a bit of a vocal crisis. Like, I think now it's like my voice is different after menopause. And I remember my longtime vocal teacher saying this to me, your voice is going to change and you're going to think you can't sing anymore, and you can. But, you know, when it happens, you're like, oh, no, I can't sing anymore. And so my voice teacher started to age. Her name is Phoebe Binkley, and I took from her since I was 19. And she got really sick, and she couldn't really teach anymore, and we were just really good friends. So I went and found another teacher, and I would take these lessons, and I would practice every day. And then Bill, my longtime guitarist, would come over every Thursday, and we'd just jam. I was like, Bill, I've got to sing. I've got to keep singing. And so I just started pulling out songs. I was like, I need to see what my voice can do on songs I have no reference point on. So I've pulled out all these crazy songs. And
it's a good idea.
Jazz songs and blues songs and acoustic songs and Appalachian songs. And over time, about 6 months later, I looked up and I said, I think maybe we have something here. I need some gigs, man. Because I had taken time off the road to find my way. So I called my manager. I was like, I need gigs, man. I don't care where it is. I just have to play this stuff in front of people. So we started going out and playing, just me and Bill, in these small listening rooms. And over time, I realized that not only could I still sing, but when the day I pulled out Ode to Billy Joe, when I hit that low note, I was like, there's something new in my voice that wasn't there before. And I really like it. And it was the first time I thought, oh, maybe I still can. Maybe this is not like my voice is an old Volvo, you know, and sturdy and it's classy and it does the job and it keeps going. I thought, oh, maybe I have a vintage Ferrari on my hands and I just don't know how to drive awesome. This thing yet.
I love that.
So these were the songs that kept me singing and led me back to my own voice.
So not only do you sing, you've added speaker and educator to your list of titles. You speak about your life in coal country as well as your life as an artist.
Yeah, well, I tell you, all of that just happened. It was crazy. I was in a training with Al Gore to give the Inconvenient Truth slideshow. And I was in his first class. There were about 50 of us. And I went out and gave it as a service project. And then at the same time, I got involved with people who were doing environmental work back in West Virginia with some of the stuff that was happening around strip mining and some of the people who didn't have clean water to drink. And so I started learning more about that, and I found some old songs that people had written like decades ago that were still about it. Was this, I found that if you sing a song that was written in 1965 and the same thing is still going on today, you don't have to say a word. The song does all the work. The song articulates what's going on and helps people feel seen and that their situation is articulated. And I started to think, oh my God, this power of music to talk to people who disagree, to make people's plight seen is amazing. So I put together I was like, well, I gotta do my own slideshow. So I put together a slideshow about social change and how music really communicates across barriers. And so I did that for a while. I'm getting ready to do some teaching at West Virginia University, and I've teach the Berkeley kids every year in Nashville when they come down and do a day with them. And it's been an unexpectedly fun thing, you know. I seeing those kids light up and getting to sort of have a discussion with them about, like, how do you do this, how do you get from where you sit to where I'm sitting, and having a discussion about, like, what's really important at the end of the day is, as opposed to, like, how do you do social media? What do you have to watch out for? All the business stuff. I sort of talked to them about, like,
heart
that's
stuff.
All great. Can you still hear your compass inside?
Yeah.
Can you still hear that?
Well, what good is wisdom and experience if you're not going to pass it on and share it, right?
Yeah, so. And it's really something to you know, I've had the experience. I've been guest hosting Mountain Stage, which is a public radio show out of my hometown lately. And a young woman came through. Her name is Rebecca Lobie, and she's a wonderful singer-songwriter with an incredible voice. And she came through, and she was one of those Berkeley kids that I talked to all those years ago.
Oh,
and
look at that.
And now she's a guest on
full
a show
circle.
I'm hosting.
That's,
and so it was, it,
that's all the proof you need that you're in
beautiful.
The right direction.
It was beautiful.
You know, that's amazing. So are you on the road for the rest of this year? Are you wrapping things up?
Off and on. I'm out for weekends mostly. And off in December, because the moving truck's coming in December.
Yes.
And I'm moving to your neighborhood.
Yeah, we're going to be neighbors. Oh,
so,
gosh.
Yeah.
The Uber ride won't cost as much.
Yeah, well, for you. It'll cost more for me and less for you. I'm moving
right.
further out. You're moving further in.
I know, exactly. Well, I can't thank you enough. And everybody who's listening, please go to KathyMattea.com for all of her tour information.
Yes,
she's
just
Mattea.com,
actually.
Mattea.com.
If you Google Kathy Mattea, it'll take you there.
Okay. So. JessMattea.com, everybody, for all of your tour information on Kathy and where she's going to be. You can go see her live. I just heard her play on the Opry. She sounds amazing as ever. And I still have to pinch myself that I'm sitting here talking to you because you were such an influence on me. Your Untasted Aww. Honey record, Walk the Way the Wind Blows. I mean, just so such a huge, huge impact on my life as an artist. And I want to thank you for that. And thank you for
Terry.
Talking to me today.
Thank you. Country Gold with Terry.